22-3497, Hunter Doster et al. Versus Frank Kendall et al. Arguments not to exceed 25 minutes per side. Mr. Ross for appellants.
Oop. Yeah, wherever works for you.
Thank you, Your Honor. Kason Ross for the United States, and with me at council table is Major Mark Nowak from the Air Force.
Very good.
The named plaintiffs failed to satisfy any of the requirements for a preliminary injunction. Plaintiffs' claims under RFRA and the Free Exercise Clause are meritless. The Air Force plainly has a compelling interest in ensuring that these deployable service members are able to fulfill their missions anywhere around the world. And no alternative can satisfy those interests to the same degree as vaccination against COVID-19. And on the equitable factors, plaintiffs fare no better. Plaintiffs have not been able to identify any irreparable injury pending during this litigation. The consequences they may face for failing to comply with the vaccination requirement are employment-based harms that this court, the Supreme Court, and indeed the district court itself acknowledged are plainly compensable and quintessentially reparable.
Is there any difference between the harm in the military context versus a typical employer context for reinstatement in the say you got a remedy ultimately of reinstatement in the military, mm-hmm. if they were discharged?
Yes.
As far as the back pay goes, is there any difference in the military rules of what you can get for back pay versus in the private sector?
I'm not sure exactly what would be available in the private sector, Your Honor, but 10 U.S.C. 1552 provides quite broad authority for the Board for the Correction of Military Records to afford pay for almost any reason. And this in discharge would be one of those reasons, including back pay. Courts have emphasized that the degree of irreparable injury required for courts have emphasized that the requirement of irreparable injury is heightened in the military context. And that's why a number of courts have held that even discharge from the military does not amount to irreparable harm.
What about, I think it's kind of black letter law that violation of constitutional rights, free speech rights, free exercise rights, that's irreparable injury per se. So why wouldn't that apply here? Setting aside, so there's tangible injuries. The tangible injuries are economic,
mm-hmm.
their duty of reassignment, and then there's the intangible injury of being pressured into violating your religious beliefs.
I think there's actually two questions there, Judge Murphy, which is one, the pressure question, and the other, which is the merits question. On the merits, that I think puts the cart before the horse in some ways, because as we've argued, the plaintiff's claims are meritless. There's no...
You know, there's a chance we might disagree with you.
Sure.
If we're just talking about irreparable harm,
mm-hmm.
then so we ought not to, you know, conflate the two.
Yes. So the Supreme Court held in Elrod that a constitutional violation of the First Amendment would likely constitute irreparable injury for purposes of a preliminary injunction.
Does that mean if we, I know you disagree on the merits, but mm-hmm. does that mean if we agree with the plaintiffs on the merits that they've already established irreparable harm?
I think there are actually separate irreparable injuries here that plaintiffs have been unable to substantiate. And it's also worth noting that this court has never endorsed that same reasoning with respect to RFRA.
I was gonna ask about that, if you had a position on whether we should treat the violation of the Constitution as an irreparable injury and perhaps not RFRA because it's statutory. What would be the, but it's still the same. Congress passed the statute to further the same interest in exercise of religion. So why would the statutory right differ from the constitutional right?
As a doctrinal matter, the Supreme Court only extended the holding in Elrod to constitutional violations. And I think just as a matter of separation of powers and the difference between constitutional and statutory injuries, there is an important distinction there. Moreover, RFRA itself simply codifies a standard of review for purposes of certain kinds of claims. And Congress was, in some ways, overruling the Supreme Court's holding in Smith with respect to the federal government. And that it did so would not necessarily go to what is required for irreparable injury for purposes of a preliminary injunction.
Do you think it's a matter of statutory interpretation or congressional intent, whether we should treat this as a irreparable injury, by which I mean what would Congress have expected to have happened?
Frankly, I'm not sure, Your Honor. That question certainly hasn't been briefed in this case. And I suppose it's just as a doctrinal matter, it would be a question of the text of the statute. Certainly Congress is within its authority.
Can we flip, so we're at the tail end of the issue.
Of course, yes.
If we flip to the beginning and justiciability,
mm-hmm.
So it seems to me that the plaintiffs have two causes of action. One is under RFRA,
mm-hmm.
and one is, as far as I can tell, correct me if you think I'm wrong, but under Ex parte Young or the judicially made private right of action to enjoin constitutional injuries. Now that would be the First Amendment claim. And so why, you have this argument citing Harkness,
mm-hmm.
that these claims should be non-justiciable under this balancing test that Harkness incorporated from the Fifth Circuit.
Right.
Why do we think that that should apply to a statutory cause of action? Wouldn't Congress have said it wanted those limits to apply in the text of the statute if it wanted those limits to apply?
So Harkness itself, Your Honor, applies the justiciability requirements that this court adopted from the Fifth Circuit in both statutory and constitutional.
I disagree with your reading of Harkness.
Mm-hmm.
Harkness had two claims.
Mm-hmm.
The first claim was this esoteric claim that I've been reassigned duties or missed duties in retaliation for my speech.
Mm-hmm.
It was not at all clear what the cause of action for that claim was, and that's where we applied the judicial balancing test. It strikes me that that might have been an Ex parte Young type action. Fine. But then when the court got to the statutory cause of action over the review boards, it considered the merits. It didn't say this is not justiciable. It said Congress created this cause of action that you didn't invoke a review board. It's judicially reviewable. That's what Congress said. We're going to review this. And then they rejected the Establishment Clause claim.
Mm-hmm.
RFRA strikes me as analogous to the portion of Harkness that didn't apply the non-justiciability test.
Respectfully, I disagree, Your Honor, especially because, and at risk of sounding like I'm talking out of two sides of my mouth, the constitutional valence of RFRA claims, which is that, Congress was noting the important protections required for religious liberties, especially when the federal government is concerned, and sought to instantiate those protections by statute. And
but in this case, I mean, as to the RFRA claim, I mean, if you want to think of this as a claim, as you put it, with a constitutional valence, and you have Congress in the text of the statute, I think quite specifically directing us to adjudicate this,
mm-hmm.
As against any branch or instrumentality of any kind as to the government, which would seem to preclude the idea that we can't adjudicate this RFRA claim against the military. I mean, clearly Congress's language encompasses the military, so what would your response to that be?
Absolutely, Your Honor. And I want to be very clear that it is not the government's position that RFRA does not apply to the military. Rather, it is, at the present juncture, plaintiff's claims are non-justiciable because they haven't been presented to an Air Force board for correction of military records or an Air Force district.
Well, where do we have the power to impose this exhaustion requirement on a statutory cause of action that Congress created that has no kind of judge-made common law exhaustion requirement?
So the Mindus test that this court adopted in Harkness is a judge-made abstention doctrine that out of respect for separation of powers, courts have recognized the need to exhaust intra-service remedies first.
Separation of powers. I mean, Congress told us to adjudicate this, and yet we're going to interpose a judge-made doctrine, also notwithstanding our unflagging duty to exercise our jurisdiction. We're going to just set all that aside based on some judge-made balancing test and say, no, after all, we're not going to adjudicate this?
So I think the court did something of that sort in Ottokamp v. Sebelius, where in a RFRA challenge to the Affordable Care Act's contraceptive mandate requirement, that the court dismissed the case for lack of prudential standing. And that was a RFRA case.
That's a good example of why we shouldn't be doing this, because in a case called Lexmark, the Supreme Court says there's no such thing as prudential standing. It says it's judge-made doctrine, and you can't impose judge-made doctrines on top of statutory causes of action, which is exactly what you're asking us to do here.
So even if you disagree with our position on justiciability, I will just note for purposes of this case that we only contend that the claims are justiciable right now. They could be justiciable in the future and may ripen in the future. But on the merits of the claims, it's worth noting that the Air Force plainly has a compelling interest in ensuring that these service members are deployable. And the best way to make sure of that is that they're vaccinated against COVID-19. There's simply no alternative that will accomplish the same goal.
What does this have to do with justiciability?
Sorry, Your Honor. I was simply saying that I had taken our colloquy to that you disagree with our arguments on justiciability. So I tried to move to the...
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. No, that's your prerogative to sort of, move on to another argument.
I'm happy to answer additional arguments about justiciability.
I mean, the other thing is that Congress did know how to create an exhaustion requirement, obviously. They've done
it
in many different contexts. And so, there's nothing... In other words, you don't have anything you can point to in the text to support an exhaustion requirement here.
Not with respect to RFRA itself, Your Honor, but rather that in the military context, courts have held in a number of cases, including cases involving religious liberty and constitutional claims, that there is something akin to an exhaustion requirement, simply to allow the military to apply its expertise to each service member's circumstances before it comes into federal court. These are complicated questions about each person's deployability, their duties, and those are questions that the military should have an opportunity to answer first.
Can I ask that led to one final question. What do you make of, if you have the text of RFRA in front of you, I don't know if you do, there's the provision that says, standing to assert a claim or defense under this section shall be governed by the general rules of standing under Article 3 of the Constitution. So this is the judicial relief provision.
Mm-hmm.
I was curious if you had a position on what that meant. I mean, under kind of the expression of one thing is the exclusion of another, you could interpret that to be a congressional judgment that so long as the core Article 3 standing requirements are met, that is all that's required and we shouldn't be imposing anything else. But I'm happy to be wrong about this if you think there is a better reading of why Congress would put this language that we have to follow Article 3 of the Constitution, which of course we'd have to follow anyways, even if they hadn't put that in. What's the point of that sentence, if you haven't?
I'm not completely sure, Your Honor, but I will reiterate that we have made ripeness arguments with respect to most of the named plaintiffs here, that their claims are not ripe.
Ripeness is both constitutional
and prudential.
And prudential. So clearly the constitutional, even if they hadn't said this, we'd have to have the constitutional.
Mm-hmm.
But I was curious whether you... I mean, would that suggest that maybe there is no such thing as prudential ripeness even in the RFRA context? Because they suggested that the only justiciability concerns we should be thinking about are those that are imposed by Article 3 of the Constitution?
I guess my best answer is that this court didn't say that in AutoCam, and so in where it dismissed the case for lack of prudential standing. That case was obviously subsequently abrogated by the Supreme Court, but I think the reasoning still stands.
Is there any reason why Congress would put this language in here? Is there any other case law in this language?
Not to my knowledge, Your Honor. I'm sorry.
It's okay.
Well, I mean, if we do want to turn perhaps to the merits, I mean, the RFRA claim maybe there's two different kinds of RFRA claims or two different aspects. I mean, they have their individual claims about whether in their particular circumstances a vaccination COVID shot is the least restrictive means to advance a compelling interest.
Mm-hmm.
But then, as you know from our other case, I mean, we have this, and maybe it's frankly, as I'm thinking about, maybe it's a question for the other case, but there is this RFRA claim that is based on the idea that RFRA itself requires the government to perform, to make an individualized determination of those same things I just talked about before imposing this burden on an individual, as opposed to the government just saying, nobody can engage in certain kinds of conduct that might affect a religious practice, where everyone has to get vaccinated. And if any believers are unhappy, they can come out of the woodwork and we'll deal with that in court. I mean, those are two quite different regimes. And so, I mean, why is it unreasonable to read RFRA to apply to the government in the first instance the same rule that we apply in court, namely strict scrutiny, and you're supposed to perform that analysis before somebody has to go through what they've been going through, as opposed to we just do that later? Why? I get the sense that the government disagrees with that sense of, you know, that RFRA is unconcerned about neutrality is one way to put it. And so why is it that you think RFRA does not ban sort of group-wide discrimination, and it's only for those individuals who where the government would fail strict scrutiny that there's a RFRA violation? I'm sorry for the long question, but it's kind of involved.
Yeah, absolutely. I think there is a lot to unpack there, Your Honor. I will start with the I don't read plaintiff's complaint or their motion for preliminary injunction to be requesting the kind of process-based relief that you're contemplating. So that's the sort of threshold point, that I actually don't think they've raised that claim in this
case. But is it possible it can be encompassed as a lesser remedy within that broader remedy that they're asking for?
Perhaps. That's not the relief the district court granted. The district court granted, so far as I understand, individualized accommodations for each of the named plaintiffs and then for the some 10,000 service members in the class. So those individualized accommodations, so far as I understand, is what the district court has required the Air Force to take in this case. Moreover, the text of RFRA itself requires that the government demonstrate to the person in court why it has a compelling interest.
Why do you think it would be such an odd statute? Do we say that Title VII bans race discrimination, or do we say that Title VII allows you to engage in race discrimination, but gives the plaintiff, the victim, a right of action in court? I think everybody would agree that it's designed to influence conduct, not just to give a cause of action on the back end. And when I read RFRA, I don't read anything that looks different. It says, the way I understand the text is it says it's a categorical command. Government shall not substantially burden a person's exercise of religion, even if the burden results from a rule of general applicability, except as provided in the, if you can prove a compelling interest. That strikes me as an obligation on government, just like Title VII is an obligation on private employers. Why is this statute different?
So I think, for one, I apologize, I don't have the provision in front of me, but in Title VII prohibits certain types of employment practices and lists quite a number of the different kinds of employment practices that are prohibited by that statute and affords a cause of action to vindicate those violations. No similar requirement is in RFRA. Moreover,
shall government shall not substantially burden a person's exercise of religion? It strikes me it's a requirement.
That's something that a court can adjudicate, but it is not something that requires the government to
determine. Yeah, it has, just like Title VII has a cause of action for violations, but the entire point of the statute is that we don't want to have to get to court because we expect the government to follow the law.
Right, but I believe in most Title VII instances, Your Honor, first the claim has to be presented before the EEOC and before it can come to federal court. Moreover, if to the extent you think
but
that...
Is it the executive branch's position that you don't have to worry about RFRA until somebody sues?
More or less, yes. Like, RFRA itself is not a record review statute and does not require the government to take any particular process.
It's not that RFRA is mandating a process. It's saying you can't do certain things you can't burden faith unless certain circumstances, i.e. compelling interest, least restrictive means, are present.
And that's something for the court to adjudicate.
Not really. I mean, I'm not aware of any rule of conduct, any law, where the law as it exists governing the person's conduct before court is somehow different from the law that we apply to them when they're in court. That would seem to be a due process violation in some cases.
So it is worth noting that if this is the court's view of RFRA, then the plaintiff's claims haven't been exhausted. And you wouldn't be able to adjudicate them now without giving the military the opportunity to do so in the first instance.
I think we're miscommunicating a little bit. I mean, read literally, the language that Judge Murphy just read says the government can't do this, cannot impose the burden until or unless, right, you make this showing in court. So if we're going to be literalist, which is different than the way we normally read, you know, it's not textual, literalism's different, sure. but if we're going to be literalist, you literally cannot impose the burden on them before you come get permission, I guess, in court, right?
I don't think it's that the court gives permission.
Well, but until a court makes the determination, until you make that showing in court.
I disagree, Your Honor, and I think that RFRA allows...
Wow. I mean, but the government, I think, is being quite literal in its reading of RFRA to say our obligation is only to make a certain showing in court. Mm-hmm. And absent that, we can do whatever we want. We can impose whatever burden we want. And if somebody doesn't like it, they can come to... They can make us go through our proofs in court. That's kind of what... That's what you're saying, right?
But
unlike Title VII, where you can't do it in the world either.
I think it's the same, Your Honor. Title VII prohibits certain types of discrimination in employment offices,
right.
Just as RFRA prohibits discrimination against religion. But there are separate exhaustion requirements in Title VII that don't apply to RFRA, and you could vindicate each of those rights by coming to federal court. And it's not that the statute provides some kind of ex-ante protection before a federal court adjudicates your claims. Rather, if you, for example, feel burdened by a particular policy, you come to federal court and sue challenging that policy. Then the government has the opportunity to explain why there's a compelling interest and why no less restrictive means could accomplish the same ends. I apologize.
To apologize because you've just been answering our questions. But I think, you know, this one, perhaps I should have waited until the class, you know, argument. But any further questions before we hear from Plaintiff's Counsel? All right, thank you. You'll have your full rebuttal.
Thank you very much.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. My name is Chris Wiest. I represent the plaintiffs today along with Mr. Bruns, Mr. Seary, and Ms. Cox. I wanted to begin my argument this afternoon by observing the standard of review, which is something you did not hear counsel for the government mention. This court, I think, appropriately summarized it in the Dahl case, Dahl versus Board of Trustees of Western Michigan University, in which it said that the review here is, quote, highly deferential, that the findings of fact must be, quote, clearly erroneous. And in conducting that clearly erroneous factual review, this court observed that the finding must, quote, strike us as wrong with the force of 5-week-old unrefrigerated dead fish.
Right.
Your Honors, when you look at the findings of the district court in this action, none of them are clearly erroneous.
There's an awful lot of law in this appeal.
There is an awful lot of law.
This is just some fact-finding exercise here.
Your Honor, no doubt. There is an awful lot of law, and I think we're happy to address all of that law and all of the government's arguments.
On justiciability, I mean, the one thing I wanted to ask you about is with respect to Article III ripeness, why doesn't the government have a point as to plaintiffs who have not gotten a definitive answer with respect to their exemption request itself? So I'm not talking about starting separation, but just, you know, what kind of a final yes or no about the exemption.
If I understand the court's question, it is getting the adjudication at least through the initial decision maker and perhaps on the appeal from the Surgeon General.
I guess when it's over, you know, there's a point where that request is finally denied as far as the Air Force is concerned. And then consequences, I suppose, start to follow. And why isn't that point when, after final denial, why isn't that the point at which it's ripe?
For several reasons, Your Honor. And let me begin here. Ripeness is tied in fundamentally with the question of standing. And Judge Sutton made that point in Winter versus Wolnicek, 834 F3rd 681 687, where he indicated, quote, the line between Article III standing and ripeness in pre-enforcement First Amendment challenges has evaporated. And then if you turn to this court's articulations in Parsons versus U.S. Department of Justice, 801 F3rd 701 710, this court says only one plaintiff needs to have that standing. below, the government conceded that two of these plaintiffs were both ripe and justiciable.
That's for us to reach it, but, you know, this is the individual PI appeal.
Right.
And these plaintiffs are getting relief individually. And the government is saying some of them don't have Article III standing for ripeness reasons to get that relief yet.
And
so that somebody else has a ripe claim doesn't answer the question whether another plaintiff is entitled to injunctive relief when her claim isn't ripe, in their view. I'm just giving you a chance to explain why it is ripe.
Right, and several reasons in response to that. First of all, we believe only one plaintiff needs to establish ripeness, but putting that aside, all of these plaintiffs' claims are ripe. And if you look at this court's test in Berry versus Schmidt, as well as the district court's findings, the first question is, what's the likelihood the harm would ever come to pass? Well, Your Honors, as you noted just a few weeks ago, there are zero standalone exemptions. Every single one of these plaintiffs are going to have, if they've not already had, their accommodation requests denied. None of them are in the class of individuals, very, very few, I think it was 100-something, that are at the end of the term of service. None of them are. And the record below supports that. Lieutenant Doster testified that none of them were in that circumstance. That factual finding was made by the district court. It's not clearly erroneous. So there is a 100% certainty.
You're arguing futility then, basically, is your argument.
In part, although I would say that the harm is ever present. And if you look at the constitutional harm that's present in this case, the coercive effect that this court recognized in Dahl in terms of the coercion of religious freedom and free exercise, that's occurring immediately. There is no doubt there are all kinds of statements of threats from the Secretary of the Air Force all the way down, including the government's own proof in this matter, all of which fundamentally establishes that there is no doubt that the harm is going to come to pass in this case. Your Honor.
Can I ask just a factual clarification question? You said in your brief that 14 of the 18 plaintiffs had received a final rejection of their appeal from the Surgeon General of the Air Force. And I looked through the record. I could only find 10 of those letters. I'm just curious if you know the status of the 18 plaintiffs. Who's left who hasn't had a rejection yet?
Your Honor, I would want to go back and talk to my colleagues on this, but I believe Colonel Anderson, I think there was a couple of others, but the number is four that have not had final adjudications through the...
Well, you said 14, but I could only find 10 letters in the record, so it might be worth clarifying on the scope of what this issue is about, actually.
Right. I think the 14 that we indicated, I'm not sure. There were some supplemental filings that occurred in this case in which we were updating. Obviously, these denials were coming in after the fact, including in some cases after the preliminary injunction was issued, that were of record below. And if it's not complete, obviously, we have those denial letters. I don't know. I'll need to check with my colleagues. I think all of that was put of record. There may have been a couple that we did not put of record. 14 have had their final denials, though. And for the other four, again, there's no doubt that there's going to be a denial for them on this record. There's no indication that that's not the case. And again, the likelihood is substantial. I mean, if you look at even the raw percentages, there's a 99% chance of a denial just on the numbers themselves. That's a highly likely chance that the harm's going to come to pass under the first Berry prong.
I don't want to hijack your argument, Tom.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, it was just like one sort of discrete question. So if there are other things you want to talk about, feel free.
Absolutely, and I'm happy to finish the ripeness and then the justiciability issues. But again,
if we turn to justiciability, so RFRA creates a statutory cause of action. Maybe there's good arguments that no judge-made tests should apply in that context, but I assume your First Amendment claim is under the judge-made cause of action, just ex parte Young. You seek an injunction to enjoin what you think is unconstitutional conduct. Now that is, as far as I can tell, I mean, ex parte Young is quite complicated, but it is a judge-made cause of action. Maybe there's more room there to impose judge-made limits on the cause of action if we think they're appropriate in our prudence. So query, why don't you talk about that? Why shouldn't we do that for the First Amendment claim?
Your Honor, because they are part and parcel and tied up fundamentally with the RFRA claim itself. And I think the courts that have addressed this, and there are several, have all found that, first of all, RFRA has no exhaustion doctrine. The Fifth Circuit found it in the Navy SEALs case. The D.C. District Court, which deals with, frankly, a great number of these military cases, found it in the Singh case. And we also saw it by the Ninth Circuit and I'm never going to get this pronunciation right, Oklavy Native American Church of Hawaii, Inc. versus Holder, which also found no exhaustion requirement in RFRA. And that comports, by the way, with the plain language text of 42 U.S.C. 2000BB-1C. Briefly, Your Honors, if you look at the purpose of RFRA and you look at the congressional discussion of it at 42 U.S.C. 2000BB-B1, Congress indicated that there were actually two purposes under which it enacted RFRA. First, to restore the compelling interest test after Smith, and secondly, to provide a claim or defense. And that claim or defense, by the way, arises, and we would submit as both ripe and justiciable at the point that it arises, when a person whose religious belief has been burdened, when that occurs, and the instance of that occurring is what gives rise to the cause of action and the entry of, quote, appropriate relief.
RFRA is not 1983. The entire point of RFRA was to expand beyond what the Constitution required. It's a statutory right. It's not a constitutional right.
That's correct.
So I don't think you could cite RFRA as the basis of enforcing any claim directly under the First Amendment.
I think, Your Honor, if this were a standalone claim without a without the second count, without RFRA, then in analyzing it that way, you would be correct. And obviously, we would get into some of the issues that sometimes get into some of the judge-made doctrines in that regard.
If we were determined you had a RFRA claim here, is there any reason to get to the constitutional claim? Is there any remedy that you're going to get under the Constitution that you wouldn't get under RFRA?
I don't believe there would be here, Your Honor. In fact, I think RFRA is probably going to provide more relief. But obviously, the fact that we're dealing with a constitutional right also, if you want to apply Harkness and Mendez and justiciability, that's one of the factors, right? What kind of claim is it? Are you alleging some regulation violation, or one of the first Mendez prongs is what's the nature of the claim? And here it's a constitutional.
Before we leave the First Amendment, what would, on the merits, so setting aside the cause of action, why wouldn't we be bound by Goldman? So Goldman is a case that said a service member wanted to wear a yarmulke and government and military regulations prohibited it. And the Supreme Court said that even pre-Smith, so this is pre-Smith world, Sherbert does not apply in the military context. So why wouldn't that rule still be applicable even if the government engages in discrimination and might avoid Smith, but why wouldn't it go headlong into Goldman, which essentially applied a rational basis test under the First Amendment?
So, Your Honor, one of the things that was going on in Goldman was a neutral and generally applicable regulation, and that was one of the points that the Supreme Court made in Goldman, that it applied equally to everyone. Obviously, here we're dealing with a discriminatory policy under the plain language of Fulton. We're dealing with an exception by exception administrative and medical exemptions. We're dealing with Tandon that talks about comparable interests. We're talking about blanket exemptions being granted to pregnant members, to end of service personnel, all of which take this outside of neutral.
I was curious, but the Goldman did have some exceptions. So they had jewelry exceptions that the court mentioned in the opinion itself. I thought that might be your response, and so I guess the counter on the other side would be, well, under the court's kind of vigorous view of looking for exceptions today, I'm not certain that Goldman would qualify as neutral and generally applicable given the exceptions for wearing jewelry and certain hairstyles.
Well, and certainly, Your Honor, the case law involving what's neutrally and generally applicable has moved substantially since Goldman was decided. We did not have then the benefit, for instance, of even, and I'm never going to get this pronunciation right, the Church of the Leukemia Bai. We did not have Smith talking about neutral and generally applicable. We did not have the development of the case law in Fulton or Tandon. Certainly, our understanding of what free exercise means today is fundamentally different than when Goldman was decided. And on that basis, it is distinguishable. I think one of the things that I wanted to mention, too, about Goldman is, and this just gets into some history of RFRA, Goldman was actually, he ended up becoming a rabbi after his time in the service. And he was one of the people that was pushing for the enactment of RFRA. And with all due respect, Goldman would not have any bearing with respect to the RFRA claim, that that's a statutory cause of action, but you would be correct that it could have some bearing on the First Amendment. Our understanding of the First Amendment has obviously evolved. This case is on four with Fulton. This case is on four with Tandon. And it's not on four on all fours with Goldman. The only exception to the headwear that was going on in Goldman were for particular militarized interests, specifically, I believe it was like the security forces that were under arms, you know, that had a purpose for keeping that headgear on so they weren't fumbling with a weapon to go in and out of a door.
So I was curious, this is, so when Congress passed RFRA, the government cites this tidbit of legislative history that suggests, in citing Goldman, that historically the court has given deference to the military, the courts have under the Constitution, and we expect deference to continue. Now, it's just legislative history, but then in Cutter, the court said the same thing with respect to prison administrators. And so it seems to me that strict scrutiny, generally speaking, is a very compelling test, and there's no such thing as deferential strict scrutiny. But now, Cutter at least suggests that we're supposed to at least give some deference, because that's what we have historically have done to the military. So how do you reconcile the fact that it is a Sherbert test, but that Congress seems to, and Cutter seems to anticipate that we're supposed to give deference under that test?
Your Honor, one of the things that Congress talks about deference is just simply whether or not something is in fact a compelling interest. In other words, you know, there was the sonar interest in training in Winter versus NRDC. The degree of deference for the government to prevail here, though, would have to arise to more deference than was even provided in Holt versus Hobbs, in which the Supreme Court in a prison context indicated that it was not going to permit a, quote, degree of deference that was tantamount to unquestioning acceptance. That would be what you would have to get to here to provide them enough deference to prevail. And the reason is simply, again, the discriminatory nature of the robust granting of secular exceptions, which they seem to have no problem with, that they grant in the thousands, while simultaneously discriminating against religious exemptions. And I would note, Your Honors, one of the things that goes on with the government is its processing. And this is also of record. There's no question about this. If you go in and you get a medical exemption, you go in to see the doctor confirms you have the condition. It might even be a condition that is not going to be undermined with respect to a COVID vaccine, for instance, pregnancy. The CDC says there's no reason not to vaccinate pregnant people. And so you're not undermining any kind of medical interest there. The government grants it with the doctor confirming it, and that's the end of it. Now take the religious processing that they engage in. They go, you confirm, just like with the doctor, that you have a sincerely held religious belief. You do that with the chaplain. He confirms it. He also happens to confirm in his memorandum that it's substantially burdened. Now, if it were equal processing, that would be the end of it, but that's not what they do. Instead, there's this entire iterative process under which they try and figure out if they can quote-unquote accommodate you, and it, as we've seen, the result of that process is a 99%, over 99% denial rate. So the discrimination begins from the outset. From the very first step, it's discriminatory in terms of what they do with the medical exemptions and the secular exemptions and what they do with the religious exemptions. And when you look at the degree of deference that they're asking for, it's undermined by the language of Holt. That's a prison context. One would think, one would think that a prisoner who has committed a crime, who has been adjudicated a criminal, would have less rights in the religious freedom context than the people that have sworn an oath to uphold and defend the Constitution. And by the way, if you look, Your Honors, at the House Report number 10388, this is another congressional piece of legislative history. Even Congress is saying in the military context, quote, seemingly reasonable regulations that are based on, quote, speculation, quote, exaggerated fears, or, quote, thoughtless policies cannot stand. The District Court of D.C. indicated that this deference that they're arguing for is not appropriate in Singh versus McHugh. And there was one more recent case that we would point to for this to refute their arguments about deference. There was a case from earlier this year from the United States Supreme Court, Ramirez versus Collier. And that, of course, was a case that dealt with whether or not a pastor could lay hands on someone who was in the process of being executed by the state of Texas. And in that case, the Supreme Court, and I'm going to quote from them, indicated that, quote, Texas asks the court to defer to its execution chamber policy determinations, but RLUIPA requires more when a policy imposes a substantial burden on sincere religious exercise. Further, no basis for deference exists given the state's history of allowing prison chaplains to audibly pray with the condemned during executions. One would think, Your Honor, that if anywhere a government is going to get deference, it's in the execution chamber and the carrying out of that process. And yet there, the Supreme Court said no, and in part the Supreme Court said no, because the state itself had allowed the activities to occur, you know, in other contexts.
I think, what's the status of the the vast majority of the religious objections have been abortion-based in the facilitation of abortion with the making or of the drugs or testing of the drugs. What's the status of the few other vaccines that apparently are not available in the United States but would not have this connection that many find problematic?
And Your Honor, it's interesting. One of the arguments the government has made is that somehow that this injunction prevents, you know, the military operations. There were two of the plaintiffs in this case, two of the original 18, who were told under the exception for assignments and operational considerations that they were going to have their pilot slots pulled, Lieutenants McCormick and Ramsberger. And what they ended up, actually Lieutenants Martin and Ramsberger, and they ended up traveling to Mexico dangerously in getting a product that doesn't have those connections. It's known as Covaxin. Our understanding is that product, at least current understanding, has no connections to the abortion process.
What if the government facilitated the obtaining of these vaccines? Would that be at least a restrictive means? It would seem the government is satisfied with these vaccines. Two of the plaintiffs have obtained them. If the government facilitated obtaining these other vaccines, would that satisfy, I know some of the plaintiffs don't want to take the vaccines for reasons unrelated to religion, which seem perfectly legitimate. The FDA has not approved them. But that would not be a religious-based objection. That would be a kind of a medical-based objection. So if the government made these vaccines available, would that be a lesser restrictive means?
Well, Your Honor, the government obviously could not compel those under other statutes, and they would be untested, unapproved by our own government. The government is obviously not.
But the government is, the military is fine if you take the vaccine, that satisfies the criterion. So they wouldn't be so you would still consider it compulsion, I suppose, if they say this is the lesser restrictive means?
I think it's problematic, and it's an equal burden on religion to say you have to take an untested, unapproved product that our FDA is not willing to put its stamp on, although it is under clinical trials in the United States, that product is, and to say that, you know, we're not even going to license it for emergency use, and that's the alternative. You need to do that. Now, here, two of these gentlemen, I don't know that it's repeatable the extraordinary means that they had to go to get it, potentially in a back alley in Mexico. But putting that aside, from a purely religious perspective, for the people that have only objections to abortive fetal tissue, obviously two of these folks had that objection, and two of these folks received this particular vaccine, and they were willing to do so consistent with their sincerely held religious beliefs. That said, I don't think it is a least restrictive means for the government to sit there and say, we're going to go and break other aspects of federal law to accommodate you. I suppose
if
they could.
How can it? If it breaks federal law, how can they have it as a approved option?
That's a great question, Your Honor. They can't mandate it, and they can't offer it in the United States, but apparently if you want to go and get it on your own overseas, then they've allowed that as an alternative option. And I don't know, I don't believe that would necessarily break federal law, but they can't import it and offer it in the United States to these folks consistent with federal law, which is why, you know, it is fiction to suggest that it's a real alternative here.
On the deference question, just to try to understand, like, the bounds of potential deference, at least as applied in this case, I mean, do you agree, I would think, and tell me if you don't, that the Air Force has a compelling interest in having a healthy force of air people or airmen, and that they have a compelling interest in people being ready, able to deploy on short notice, et cetera. You agree with those compelling interests?
We agree that those, on a very generalized basis,
right,
are
a very
compelling interests. Obviously not going to be compelling in the context of being able to intrude on First Amendment and RFRA because of the requirement for more specificity that the Supreme
right.
Court is.
No, I get that. But as far at that level of generality, you don't have any quarrel with their compelling interest, the ones that they're asserting.
As a general compelling interest, we don't believe that they're sufficient to intrude on First Amendment rights. They don't rise to the specificity, particularly.
Yeah.
I mean, they're right.
No, yeah, I get it. And then, so it's as to least restrictive means that you would, I think, you tell me. How do you feel about deference in that area,
Your Honor? There is no way that they can possibly satisfy least restrictive means when they are allowing robust numbers of secular exceptions. They cannot do it. If this were a blanket, no exception policy, I think it'd be a tougher case, frankly. That isn't this case.
What about their argument that, and this is something they emphasize much more in their briefing for this appeal as opposed to the stay motion, that these exemptions are different in kind because the religious one is permanent, whereas the other ones are temporary?
Well, Your Honor, that's simply not true. And I know that they've taken that position at length, and we filed a 28J letter in part yesterday to deal with that. What the regulations say, both the Department of Defense regulations and the Air Force instructions say, are that, yes, you can get these religious exemptions, but they're subject to ongoing review. And if circumstances change and the government makes the same showing it's initially required to make under RFRA, then they can, at any point in time, pull them back. And so this suggestion that somehow these are quote-unquote permanent simply isn't true. Now, we expect, just as a matter of fact, the majority of these 18, when the government approves the Covaxin product, to receive the vaccine. And in that sense, we are dealing with a temporary exemption. In the same way, by the way, as to the majority, but yes.
It's still different than the admin exemption, right? Because isn't the admin exemption predicated on just 6 months and you're discharged?
Well, that's one admin exemption. The other admin exemption that they have is the vaccine placebo, right? And so if you go and you're part of a black vaccine study and you get the placebo, you get an administrative exemption for that as well.
But aren't the anybody who gets the admin exemption, is there a presumption that they're non-deployable? Or is it folks that are going to not be deployable in those 6 months, and so they're distinct from the plaintiffs?
So, Your Honors, there's two levels of waiver. Obviously, there's the exemption itself, and then there's another level of waiver for deployability. And this was also in the Department of Defense instruction that we filed in the 28J. I think it was 649007, and so you can get a MAJCOM commander essentially to waive the deployment, and that occurs not infrequently. We also think that same waiver to policy raises the same issues under Fulton, because it's available in Dahl. It doesn't even matter that they're granting them. The fact that it's there suggests that you cannot, you know, rely on that. The government cannot rely on that to say that these are somehow different. The reality is they're waivable. And there's exceptions to them.
You want to wrap up for 60 seconds on this one?
Your Honor, I'm happy to. Just briefly, we believe, not that we believe, the district court's findings were all supported with factual evidence of record. The district court appropriately applied the circuit's case law, and its injunction for these 18 plaintiffs should be affirmed.
Thank you, Your Honor. We'll hear from Mr. Ross. And Mr. Ross, one thing I want to ask you, just to sort of identify what's contested here and what isn't.
Sure.
As you know, the plaintiffs have argued throughout the litigation, at least in this court, that the Air Force has not granted any standalone religious exemptions, meaning exemptions to people who were not eligible for some other exemption as well. I mean, you know what I'm saying.
Yes.
Right.
I just want to make sure that I want to be very clear.
In other words, you know, the numbers that the government has been citing, like 138, or, you know, they obviously change, but that they have argued that in each of those instances, the person was separately eligible for an administrative exemption, I think was most of them, or maybe a medical. And we pointed that out in our opinion on the stay motion, and said it appears that the government's not disputing this. And so, you know, for purposes of our decision, the number is actually zero. Now, having read the government's briefing in both appeals, I thought the government sort of pointedly omitted to dispute that same point. And so I want to, you know, am I overlooking something in the briefing? Has the government actually disputed that, is the government asserting that some of these were standalone religious exemptions as opposed to just people who had another reason to get an exemption anyway?
Yes. Sorry. I just want to be very clear. Yeah. There are service members who have been granted religious exemptions who would not be eligible for administrative or medical exemptions.
Okay. And so, I mean, do you have anything for us to back that up?
It's not in the record, Your Honor, and the service members who have been granted those religious...
How come the government doesn't say that in any of its briefing? I mean, you know, I mean, this issue was highlighted before these briefs were submitted, and the government just doesn't take this on.
Mostly because, frankly, Your Honor, it's just not in the record here. And if anything, it shouldn't bear on the disposition of this appeal, because for the reasons we've stated in the briefs, the basis for the different kinds of exemptions are fundamentally different. I will emphasize pointing to...
But the point is, the government has been saying, hey, you know, we granted 138 of these, and so, you know, among other things, a person should have to go all the way through the process before their claim is ripe. Well, if all 138 were granted to people who were within 6 months of leaving the service anyway, then that rather takes the wind out of the government's sails in saying we're granting some of these. We're granting some as long as you're eligible for another one, is their argument.
So two responses, Your Honor. One, I apologize for the lack of clarity in the briefing, but again, this just isn't in the record, and there aren't publicly available sources that we can point to because these are, you know, individual circumstances that are sensitive.
But you did have one sentence in the reply where you said, the Air Force has now granted over 130 religious exemptions, which have been not granted to service members who would qualify for an administrative exemption.
Exactly.
But have been granted under similar circumstances. So is this something like the admin exemption requires 6 months, and it was 6 months and 2 days, and therefore you granted a religious exemption? Is that what the clause, but have been granted under similar circumstances, was trying to convey?
It's within a year. So there is a delta between administrative and religious exemptions.
Okay.
And I think that's meaningful. But also, the fact that religious exemptions are treated the same as administrative exemptions is also meaningful.
But why don't you treat religious exemptions, the government, the Air Force, treats religious exemptions as permanent. But the government doesn't treat medical exemptions as temporary. So imagine a hypothetical where...
It does treat it as temporary. Right.
Medical exemptions as temporary.
Yeah.
Correct. And what if somebody has an allergy to all the current vaccines, but wouldn't have an allergy to one of the new vaccines that the plaintiffs wouldn't object to taking? So once those vaccines get approved by the FDA, the person with the allergy to all the other vaccines can take this. So that's temporary. Why is that person not exactly similarly situated to a plaintiff who would also be willing to take that vaccine?
The first reason is that if the person with an allergy takes the vaccine, they would be harmed by the existing vaccine. They would be harmed by taking it. And so the military grants the exemption on that basis.
But the entire point of RFRA is that we're supposed to treat a religious objection as almost analogous to a medical objection.
But the government's interest in treating them differently is could not be more different, because the reason for, in fact, it the government's compelling interest in denying religious exemptions runs in the same direction for Your Honor's hypothetical of granting an exemption for a service member with an allergy.
But why would it? Why? Okay, so the interest is different, but why is one temporary and one permanent?
So it is. I will point the court to DOD Instruction 1332.45, which requires that all service members be deployable for 12 months consecutively, and if they're not, they're subject to a retention decision. So apologies to fight the hypothetical, but if there's not a vaccine that's approved that would not, or that would still contraindicate the service member's allergy, they would be evaluated for separation from the service.
But why wouldn't you treat the individual with a religious objection the same way and say, okay, we'll give you 12 months and then we'll reassess things, and then within that time, maybe a new vaccine came out.
None of the service members here have actually requested that. So record entry 11 is the relevant materials for their letters requesting exemptions. I believe they're all permanent. And so, yes, maybe they assert in their briefing now that the exemptions are temporary, but that's not what they said to the Air Force.
They said in the PI. It was in the PI hearing. I think all three of the individuals who testified in the PI hearing that they would be willing to take a vaccine that was FDA approved and didn't have the connections.
And on August 19th, the Novavax vaccine was given an emergency use authorization and is not connected to fetal stem cells. And two of the plaintiffs have since been vaccinated, or excuse me, two of the plaintiffs testified that they would be amenable to taking that vaccine, but have not.
Well, I mean, that's beyond the ken of...
Absolutely. I'm merely offering it for the court's consideration. I will turn to the merits because we've had quite a lot of discussion about the threshold issues. But plaintiffs effectively admit that with respect to these named plaintiffs, that there is a compelling interest in ensuring that they're vaccinated. And there is no less restrictive means.
Well, they don't admit that. They admit at some level of generality, you know, the government has a compelling interest in a healthy force. I don't think they're admitting anything really as to them.
But the important question here, Judge Kethledge, is the district court never considered this question.
But why, isn't it your burden?
Yeah,
I was curious.
I was going to get into.
I was curious who, at first I thought it was the plaintiffs that should tell us kind of what their job duties are. But then when I realized that the government bears the burden of proof to demonstrate a substantial interest or the Sherbert test with respect to each individual plaintiff, with respect to each individual circumstance, shouldn't we? It's astonishing to me that I read the government's brief, and I have no idea from just reading the government's opening brief alone what any of the plaintiffs does. And as I understand Ocentro and Hobby Lobby, we're supposed to be asking, does the government have a compelling interest in forcing this individual who engages in these duties and has these circumstances to take this vaccine? And the government is just at the highest level of generality that Ocentro and Hobby Lobby say is insufficient.
So part of the problem with that, Your Honor, is that this case was prematurely adjudicated. At the time the government filed its opposition to the preliminary injunction, we were able to provide declarations from only five of the plaintiff's commanders to testify as to why it was necessary to have them vaccinated, describing their duties and whatnot. And we cite all of those declarations in both the opening brief and the reply brief. And I can get into them in detail if that would be helpful.
They seem to be rather boilerplate.
I disagree, Your Honor, because each of the declarations, Lieutenant Colonel Pelliers, Colonel Renz, Colonel Reese's, all explain in detail those particular service members' obligations and why they might be called to deploy on 72 hours notice, for example, or why other means would not sufficiently accomplish the government's interests for having those plaintiffs be deployed. And these are the kinds of military interests that fall in the heartland of those military officials' ken of expertise.
Yeah, and, but I mean, there's a whole level of analysis that we really haven't even gotten into as to least restrictive means. You know, somebody who's had COVID twice, hypothetically, whether a shot for that person is the least restrictive means to meet some of these goals. And I mean, anyway. Yeah.
So I will point you to Colonel Pohl's declaration, Your Honor, which it systematically goes through each of these ostensibly less restrictive means, which will not satisfy the same concerns.
But I mean,
and I can say with respect,
query whether his declaration is going to answer the question in each plaintiff's particular circumstances.
That may be true, but that's also not analysis that the district court concluded or contemplated.
Well, okay, I know that. And, I mean, I know you have a lot of criticisms of, like, you know, the particulars of the district court's work. We're more focused here on sort of the outcome.
Sure.
And as Judge Murphy points out, it's the government's burden to demonstrate that that as to each individual, his or her circumstances, there's a compelling interest, and the vaccination is the least restrictive means. And frankly, the government's brief just doesn't even address that. There's a couple of four examples in the reply brief. But I mean, if we're deciding to adjudicate the RFRA claim, I mean, the government has almost forfeited any individualized analysis, which the government says is necessary now that we're in court. The government's basically forfeited that, unless I'm missing something.
Respectfully, Your Honor, part of the government's brief was, certainly the opening brief was taking issue with the analysis done by the district court. And the district court never performed exactly what you are saying. That is, it never considered any of the five declarations that I just listed, provided by plaintiff's commanders, and didn't consider whether, at least in those specific circumstances, that the government satisfied its burden or not. We don't know the answer to that question.
I mean, we review judgments, we review orders, we don't really grade homework that much. And the question here is just whether these folks are substantively entitled to the injunctive relief that they got or not. It's not whether the district court skipped a step here or there. And it's been the government's burden all along, and I'm just kind of scratching my head. I mean, as Judge Murphy said, really nothing in the blue brief. The blue brief is like most of the chips are on justiciability. In the reply brief, and it was fair in the reply because they get into it in the red brief, but the reply brief just really doesn't engage in this directly. It's just sort of a couple, literally, for example, two or three people. How can we vacate this award of relief to these individuals if we reach the merits when the government hasn't made the effort to show what the government says RFRA requires you to show?
I think that there are actually a lot of declarations in the record, Your Honor, substantiating.
But it's not our job to go sift through those.
No, absolutely not.
Sort that out. I believe you have to kind of make an argument that here's the compelling interest, here's the least restrictive means, here's why they're wrong in saying we haven't met that.
And I respectfully disagree that the government didn't do so. We cited declarations from Lieutenant General Schneider.
Do you think the job duties? Are the job duties completely irrelevant of any of the plaintiffs?
No, and I can discuss any of them.
Why would you not tell us what the job duties are? Like, I know what a lot of the job duties are, but it's from reviewing the evidence.
Mm-hmm.
I would think that the job duties go into whether masking or social distancing or other things are narrowly tailored, unless you're saying, and this gets into the next case a little bit, but unless you're saying these generalized interests are perfectly fine for every conceivable Air Force member.
So we did attempt to do that in the reply, in contesting, the general assertions in plaintiff's response brief. Part of the problem in this particular case, and this also bleeds into the next case as well, is that there are 18 named plaintiffs, and, given the constraints on word limits for briefs, we are trying to respond to the district court's reasoning at an appropriate level of generality to explain why that analysis was wrong. And we made every effort to do that, and I apologize if you are disappointed.
We're not trying to keep you either, all right? When it boils down to it, do we have an adequate basis to rule one way or another? So that's okay. Any further questions for this? You can have 60 seconds to wrap up if you'd like, and then we'll move on to the next case, I guess.
Sure. We haven't discussed irreparable injury at all, but I will just underscore that.
We did at the beginning.
Oh, I suppose that's true. Sorry, it's been a while. I will just reiterate that the district court abused its discretion in granting relief to these 18 named plaintiffs. To the extent this court believes that any single one of them should have been granted or not been granted a preliminary injunction, and the Air Force could enforce the vaccination requirement against any single one of them, then it need vacate the preliminary injunction with respect to all of them for more appropriately tailored relief.
All right, very well. Thank you both for your arguments in this appeal.